We're seeing all this combination of unanticipated strength and resentment merge.
China responds to new U.S. trade tariffs. It's Tuesday, May 14th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, a Rohingya health crisis is growing, forced religious conversions in Pakistan, a new language in Australian politics, forest biodiversity, and a stellar baby boom. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Deepening its trade war with the United States and sending world financial markets into a slide, China announced higher tariffs Monday on $60 billion worth of American goods in retaliation for President Donald Trump's latest penalties on Chinese products. Tariffs of 5% to 25% will take effect June 1st on about 5,200 American products, including batteries, spinach, and coffee, according to the Finance Ministry. The announcement followed a move by the United States Friday to raise duties on $200 billion of Chinese imports up to 25%. That's up from 10%. American officials accused China of backtracking on commitments it made in earlier negotiations. 2 days of trade negotiations between the United States and Chinese representatives broke up Friday without any agreement. Both countries have indicated more talks are likely, but does the current stalemate between the United States and China portend a larger, more drawn-out confrontation, or confrontations between the two countries? That's what VOA Asia's Ira Melman asked Dr. David Lampton, a China expert and fellow at the Stanford Asia-Pacific Research Center in Palo Alto, California.
Yes, and I think we're in, our two nations are in an increasingly comprehensive confrontation, not limited just to trade, although that's the news of the moment, but it includes a mounting arms race, it includes diplomatic competition around the world, with China operating in Latin America and Venezuela and so forth, Middle East, in places where we've traditionally seen ourselves as dominant. And then there, of course, we're operating on China's periphery, wooing Vietnam, trying to keep the Philippines in the U.S. column, so to speak. And so we see each country competing with the other for diplomatic influence. And then, of course, we've got these economic conflicts.
What is it about the current stances of both countries that put them at loggerheads?
Well, I think, in a way, we have to be a little philosophical and see that the last three, four decades of globalization have led to massive populations rising economically and had lots of positive benefits, but also all over the world, it has increased economic inequality, and those people, broadly speaking, who have not benefited from globalization as much as they think they should have, or indeed would have been more equitable had they benefited, they now are finding political voice, and we see the rise of populist leaders really all over the world, and Mr. Trump and Mr. Xi, which I would say for these purposes is a somewhat populist leader. But we see this phenomenon in Duterte in the Philippines. We see it in Erdogan in Turkey. We are having the rise of leaders that are trying to galvanize domestic political support by feeding their dissatisfactions with inequality and volatility in world markets and the difficulty of poorly educated people to get middle-class paying jobs and so forth. So I think this is a global phenomenon, and China and the United States are just the two biggest examples.
So you see pretty much the same reason, rather than really stark differences between these two sides, China and the United States.
The long and the short of it is that China has increased its capabilities, I think, much more rapidly than many anticipated. And it's predictable, I think, how China's using this new power. But nonetheless, it's a surprise. So what we have is a kind of volatile mixture of unanticipated strength on the one hand and resentment and in much of our society by the people who have been left behind and the unfair practices that they think, and I think correctly in many cases they're accurate, that China has used to get ahead. And so we're seeing all this combination of unanticipated strength and resentment merge.
What do you say to those who say China has been ripping the United States off?
First of all, there's a lot of truth in that, so we can't dismiss that. And we would look at intellectual property, forced technology transfer, not allowing our most competitive firms access in China, stealing intellectual property, cyber violations, and so on. So there is a real there. And the U.S. has had enough, and I think it's justifiably had enough. So China's going to have to respond to all of that. But I think we don't, and if they don't, we're going to have very big problems. But I think there's another side of the story, too, and that is that the U.S. has not been doing the basic things it needs to do to be competitive. And so at the same time we blame and try to get China to mend its ways, we have to increase our, I think, comprehensive national capabilities. I mean, our healthcare is far from anywhere near the top of the industrial world in terms of outcomes, not to mention the cost of it. Our educational systems, state university systems, are reducing their input all the time into public education at an affordable cost at the college level. Our infrastructure, we've allowed to deteriorate, as everybody who drives to work can see clearly. And so at the same time, I don't think we should be in a frame of mind of blaming China for all our ills. Because frankly, if China behaved better in terms of its economic behavior, we'd still have enormous problems. So I think we have to, kind of have a balanced outlook. At the same time we push China hard on these issues, we shouldn't engage in destructive to ourselves activity, and we ought to focus on the things we can change, whether we have any cooperation from China or not.
When I was in college so many decades ago and taking sociology classes, the term ethnocentrism kept cropping up. For those who don't know ethnocentrism, that's the evaluation of other cultures using the standards and customs of your own.
I think that both countries have a sort of exceptionalism. They're both ethnocentric. And frankly, if you look at the political theme that Xi Jinping is using in China to the great revitalization of Chinese civilization and packaging what he's doing in trade and military development and so on, you're hard-pressed to say, how is this different than Make America Great Again?
U.S. President Trump started raising tariffs last July over complaints China steals or pressures companies to hand over technology. Washington also wants Beijing to roll back government support for Chinese companies striving to become global leaders in robotics and other technology. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit online at voanews.com. China imposes tariffs on $60 billion of U.S. exports. Judicial probe opens into Christchurch mosque shootings. Taiwan MPs urge to back government in Asia first same-sex marriage law. Is it time for Vietnam's companies to go global? Philippines votes in polls expected to boost Duterte. Expanded coverage of all these stories and much more can be found on Facebook at VOA Asia. You can also stop by our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. The flood of Rohingya refugees into Bangladesh in late 2017 created a sudden medical emergency. Now it has turned into a protracted crisis. For VOA News, reporter Dave Grunbaum shows how healthcare community is adapting.
Listen to yourself.
Rahimullah,
a Rohingya refugee is getting a medical exam. He's 62 years old and a diabetic.
When I suffer from my diabetes, I feel my lips are drying and feel thirsty as well as pain across my whole body. I become restless and cannot sleep.
He receives a free evaluation in medicine at this hospital run by Médecins Sans Frontières, also known as Doctors Without Borders. This is one of about 180 medical centers that have opened since late 2017 to take care of more than 700,000 Rohingya Muslims who fled to southern Bangladesh from neighboring Myanmar. It's because of a military crackdown that United Nations investigators have said was executed with genocidal intent, accusations Myanmar denies. The refugees now live in overcrowded camps, and the poor living conditions contribute to many health problems.
The poor living conditions in the camps are the leading cause of many multiple illnesses, including diarrheal diseases, skin diseases, respiratory infections.
Toilets shared by many families can become filthy. There are times when clean water is scarce in sections of the camps, making it difficult for some refugees to find a place to even wash their hands.
When this crisis started more than a year and a half ago, there was an immediate need for emergency care to take care of refugees with wounds from bullets and knives. There were outbreaks of measles and diphtheria that needed to be contained. But as things have stabilized and this has turned into a prolonged crisis, medical teams are scaling up resources to take care of the refugees' long-term health care needs.
Medical teams say there's a lot of demand to help refugees with chronic issues such as diabetes, high blood pressure, as well as patients with constant pain such as Abdul Jabbar.
I feel good because they made me walk and tested my blood. They give me medicine and treat me well.
So we assume that in the coming future there will be a big need in providing care to respond to this chronic condition that people are living with.
The medical teams work under tough conditions. The examination rooms in this outpatient center are small and separated not by walls but by tarps. While Rahimullah is being examined, you can hear a patient in a nearby room shouting in pain. Nonetheless, the doctors, nurses, and medical assistants will keep at it because so many refugees are depending on them. Dave Grunebaum for VOA News, Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh.
Happening now in Asia, the United States has banned six Chinese technology companies from exporting U.S. technologies and goods. The U.S. Commerce Department said four Chinese firms, which also have offices in Hong Kong, are being banned because of their support of Iran's military programs in violation of U.S. sanctions. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're with us today on VOA Asia. In the predominantly Muslim country of Pakistan, less than 5% of the population is non-Muslim. Among them are Christians and Hindus. Rights groups say hundreds of young Hindu and Christian girls are forcibly converted to Islam every year in Pakistan. While some are kidnapped, others are married off to Muslim families. VOA's Mohammed Saqib spoke with relatives who say that two young girls in their family were kidnapped and forced to convert. We have more in this report narrated by Bejan Hamdard.
This is Kavita of Godki district in Pakistan's Sindh province. Kavita is pleading with the government to help return her two younger sisters. She says they were kidnapped in March and converted to Islam.
My mom and I were sitting there. A car came with men with guns in their hands and they took away my sisters. Next day, we found out that my sisters have changed their religion.
Locals here say that forced conversions to Islam have become more and more common in various villages in Sindh province in recent years. Young girls are often the primary victims. Most villagers say that kidnappings are being orchestrated in a historic shrine in Godki district called Barchundi Sharif. Shrine staff deny the allegations and say non-Muslims voluntarily come to their shrine to accept Islam.
Thanks to Allah, many people accept Islam here. Even entire families accept it here. This is not a new phenomenon. We have been doing this for centuries.
Police here paint a different picture. They say the two sisters left home to get married in Punjab province, which allows teenagers under 18 to marry. Kotki District's deputy commissioner did not comment on the case, but told VOA the government is doing its job responsibly.
No one has the right to convert anyone by force. Everyone in Pakistan has a constitutional right to follow their own religion.
Human Rights Commission of Pakistan's chairperson, Usman Nourani, says forced conversions of young girls in Pakistan is not only real, but a business as well.
Religious figures run this like a business. They get money for conversions. They say that converting someone to Islam will be rewarded by God. And this influences our whole criminal justice system, including police, judges, prosecutors, and others involved.
The sister's case made headlines in Pakistan and to the capital's high court in Islamabad. The two young girls said they married the Muslim men and became Muslims voluntarily. But Kavita's family doubts that story. Right groups are calling on political leaders to do more to protect religious freedom so minority groups can feel safe to follow their religion. For Mohammed Saqib in Pakistan, Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
Coming up, new words are heard in Australia's parliament. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia, Sri Lanka blocked access to Facebook and WhatsApp after Christian attacks on mosques and Muslim-owned stores Sunday in reaction to a Facebook post. The South Asian nation has been on edge since the Easter morning bombings of churches and hotels that killed more than 250 people. You can visit VOA Asia Facebook and voanews.com for top stories. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, history has been made in Australia. As a politician in the Northern Territory spoke an Aboriginal language with an interpreter for the first time in Parliament. The fight to use Indigenous languages in the chamber has lasted for years, as Phil Mercer tells us more.
Independent MP Yinia Mark Goyala addressed his parliamentary colleagues in his Aboriginal language that's spoken in parts of Arnhem Land in Australia's Northern Territory.
I acknowledge the Indigenous Language and Culture Program.
Through an interpreter, he delivered a blistering speech about the lack of bilingual education in remote Indigenous areas.
We need to provide pathways that allow for success.
The Northern Territory has more than 100 First Nation languages and dialects. In the past, politicians were told to speak only English in Parliament and that it would be disorderly if they didn't. It was then decided that lawmakers could use a language other than English only if they provided a written translation in advance. Those rules were scrapped in March after concerted pressure from Indigenous politicians. Goyala says it's a breakthrough.
It's taken a long time. It wasn't allowed in the beginning of the term, but I pushed and pushed, and finally, just this year, it's been approved. I feel real confident doing it in my language.
It's estimated 250 Aboriginal languages were spoken in Australia before European settlement in 1788. Of the 145 still in use today, more than 100 are considered to be critically endangered. Indigenous languages are not just a means of communication. They express knowledge of all aspects of society, from history and family relationships to astronomy, biology, and food. Each language is associated with an area of land and has a deep spiritual importance. After decades of debate, university researchers believe that all Indigenous languages in Australia are descended from one common language. The United Nations General Assembly declared that 2019 would be the International Year of Indigenous Languages. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This news from VOA Asia. China says it is imposing tariffs on $60 billion worth of imports from the United States, retaliating after President Donald Trump boosted taxes on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods sent to the United States and moved to impose duties on another $300 billion of exports beginning June 1st. Pay nothing to visit VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the United Nations released a new global report on the environment this past week. It says the decline of nature is unprecedented and species extinction is accelerating. The study warns that many factors are having a severe impact, including climate change, pollution, deforestation, and invasive plants and animals. In South Africa, the Garden Route National Park is located along one of the country's most beautiful stretches of coastline, and it's also a place where a large number of invasive plants have taken over. VOA's Deborah Block takes us there to find out how officials are working to keep them at bay.
South Africa's Garden Route National Park offers visitors lush forests and a dramatic coastline. But the biodiversity of the 650-square-kilometer park is under threat from invasive species.
The number one threat in the Garden National Park for biodiversity at this point is alien species, alien plant species. We have a diversity of species, about 200 alien species, but only about 10 or 15 to 20 maybe are transformer species that really can change your area.
The invasive plants compete with the scrub and trees that are endemic to the area. Wildfires in 2017 and 18 damaged much of the forest, but the destruction made it easier for park rangers to identify and eradicate invasive species.
Fire also affords one the opportunity to be able to walk into the area because there are less indigenous vegetation immediately behind it. Your alien plants grow faster than indigenous, so you see them in the first 2 or 3 years. So you have that window of opportunity where you have to kill them before they make seed. If you can do that, then you gained a lot from having the fire.
What is key is to ensure that there are follow-up control measures that are put in place so that if there had been a fire, then you actually control the regrowth of invasive alien species after the fire.
New indigenous species are still being found in the park.
There's a sense of awe and wonder still in a lot of these tucked away places. And at the same time, there's species of plants that seem to disappear for long periods of time and, you know, are considered extinct. And then after extreme events, they actually resurface.
Keeping the biodiversity for visitors to enjoy for years to come. Deborah Block, VOA News.
VOA's Rick Pantaleo takes a moment to announce a stellar baby boom. Well, a few billion years after the fact.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study by researchers from Spain's University of Barcelona and the French Besançon Astronomical Observatory suggests that the Milky Way galaxy experienced a period of intense star-making about 2 to 3 billion years ago. Writing in the journal Astronomy and Astrophysics, the scientists reached their findings by analyzing data gathered by the European Space Agency's Gaia satellite. The researchers say they found that about half of the stars that make up the Milky Way's galactic disk were created during the stellar baby boom. Before the time of this boost in star formation, the scientists suggest that our galaxy was beginning to run low on the gas used to make stars when a satellite galaxy crashed into and merged with the Milky Way. It's thought that the satellite galaxy was rich with this gas, and when it merged with our home galaxy, boosted its star-making capabilities. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us on the radio throughout Asia. Great radio stations like Chiang Mai University, Radio FM 100 at Chiang Mai University in Thailand. We thank everyone there who's tuned in today. And if you haven't caught most of our program, some of our program, whatever the case may be, find us online at VOA Asia Facebook and voanews.com. We also thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Nelson Lopes, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day.